Talk 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Yes, a big thank you as always to the two Johnnies for keeping us entertained this afternoon. It is Wednesday, the 6th of April. I'm Shane Dawson. You're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, we have a packed hour of premium sports content. It is the eve of the Masters, and we'll be dialing into Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson to get the latest from Augusta. Ruby Walsh is over in Aintree with the action going to post tomorrow afternoon. We'll have all the latest news from the world of horse racing with Ruby. In Gaelic Games, Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray will be live previewing this weekend's football and Camogie finals. And if that wasn't enough, we'll also be chatting to David Snaid ahead of another massive night in the Champions League, and we'll also be getting his thoughts on the breaking news that reports from ESPN report that Erik ten Hag is set to become the next manager of Manchester United. So lots to get through over the course of the next hour. As always, if you want to get in touch, drop us a text on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Yes, hello there. It is great to have your company on this Wednesday evening, wherever in the world you are tuning in from, as it is Preview Central this evening. First up, we turn our attention to the golf, and I'm delighted to say I'm in the company of Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson, two of the most respected views and journalists in the world of golf. And gentlemen, before we get into it, because obviously there's been so much chat around Tiger Woods, I have to begin our chat by playing you a bit of audio, because Doug, you had a public press conference, but it nearly turned into a one-on-one chat.
Tiger, when will you decide Doug, whether you can play and what determines that?
Where's Over Doug? Here, sorry, Doug, where are you at?
Somewhere around here, far right.
Yep, they got you. Yep.
When will you decide whether for sure you're playing, and what will determine that?
Well, as of right now, I feel like I am going to play.
Well, there are the thoughts of Tiger Woods and Doug Ferguson. We'll be getting the thoughts of Doug Ferguson very, very shortly. He's with Greg in a few moments' time. But Greg, I heard you chatting to Marie and Ruby yesterday, and obviously you kind of went through the Tiger Woods scenario, and will he, won't he? The situation is he's currently down to play. Whether or not he stays the course of the whole tournament is another question altogether. You gave your opinions on who might be the standout winner for yourself. But I suppose now that we're 24 hours later, what is the situation over in Augusta in terms of the course, in terms of the weather? Because I've seen a lot of rainy and stormy videos and pictures emerging from Augusta. What's the state of play over there?
Well, the first thing to say is that we've got people back on the golf course, people back on the range. We had a huge storm yesterday. Even by, you know, Augusta standards, it was torrential rain. So that softened the course. It forced a suspension of play for the entire afternoon. We had another suspension this morning. But, it's sort of sun breaking through very, very slightly through light cloud. Hopefully that's the end of it. So it's a nice scene, but it's not perfect over the first few practice days. That's for sure.
So we should be okay for the par three.
The par three, the kids in their little caddy overalls, a lot of the children of players end up as being caddies for their obviously the players in the par three. They're all ready to go and look like the par three is going to go ahead. In fact, Trevor Immelman has just double bogeyed the first hole of the par three. That's not a good sign for the 2008 Masters champion.
That's live reporting, as it should be, as the golf just is happening over your shoulder.
Yeah, well, you know, the par three, it's not to be taken too seriously. The last thing you want to do is to win it, to be honest. If you've got real eyes on winning the actual Masters, as we know, no one's won the par three and I think won the Masters at the end of it.
Yeah, no, that is indeed correct. And I think I saw, you mentioned all the kids caddying for people. Rory McIlroy's little one, I think, is caddying. And well, I think
Poppy, yeah.
Yeah, like 2 or 3 years of age. So I'm assuming she's not carrying the whole bag around.
No, I don't think so.
But looking ahead, I suppose, Greg, obviously the par three is today and it all kicks off tomorrow as well. Obviously, we've talked at length over Tiger Woods in terms of his situation, and there's been so much eyes around Tiger, but slightly opposite sentiments coming from Rory McIlroy's comments, who's hoping that a new, more relaxed mindset can give him an edge at the Masters this week, a tournament that he says he is now okay with not winning. What do you read into those remarks?
And Rory has had, obviously, so many experiences at the Masters of various different types, and most of them have been experiences which haven't been, you know, in the territory of being satisfactory. You know, you go back to 2011 when he had a lead of four shots going into the final 18 holes, still led by one going into the back nine, and then had an awful meltdown on 10, 11 and 12. Three holes which obviously have seen lots of meltdowns over the years, and Rory had possibly the most spectacular of all. And, you know, he came here in 2015 having won his third major golf championship with the prospect of the career Grand Slam, and every Masters since then he has been asked the question, what about the career Grand Slam? Is it going to happen here at Augusta? And he's got, you know, somewhat weary of it. He's dealt with it in many, many different ways. He's dealt with it with, you know, all guns blazing, go for every flag and pin sort of way. And he's gone, I think, this year with a sense that caution is the byword for all of this. And Doug Ferguson actually is right beside me here, and he's witnessed a few Rory moments over the years. By the way, Doug, you weren't here for it. They played your moment with Tiger at the press conference yesterday at the start of this.
Which moment was that?
Well, I think when he started looking for you around the press conference.
Doug, actually, yeah, we can play it again for you. It's only 20 seconds of audio, have a listen to this.
Got it. Tiger, when will you decide whether you can play and what determines that?
Where's
over
Doug?
Here, sorry.
Sorry, Doug, where are you at?
Somewhere around here. Far right.
Yep, they got you. Yep.
When will you decide whether for sure you're playing, and what will determine that?
Well, as of right now, I feel like I am going to play.
Doug Ferguson, Tiger Woods, best of friends.
It reminded me of Belrive a couple years ago, as it relates to the Ryder Cup at Oakland Hills, where I was standing on the left side of the room, and Tiger had no idea where I was, and he said, "Where are you?" And I said, "Left, way left. Think Phil on the 18th at Oakland Hills." And I think you figured that out. I was way left, not quite out of play. Anyway, good to hear from you. How are you?
Very well, Doug, very well. I suppose Greg and Gary Murphy were chatting to Marie Crowe and Ruby Walsh yesterday and talked at length about Tiger Woods. But I suppose just continuing the conversation and developing the story and just touching on that comment there from Tiger, you've obviously interviewed him a number of times over the years. Personally, do you feel he is being sincere in terms of going out and he has this winning mindset and he truly believes he can win the tournament? So that means he truly believes he can finish the tournament, given all that is hampering him at the moment.
Yeah, I think he's sincere about he wouldn't be here if he didn't think he could at least try to win or think about winning. And I actually believe that. There was an interesting side bet, however that stuff works in America, where the over-under on a score is of being 75, and whoever knows. But I keep coming back to the idea of he's not playing unless he has a reasonable idea of what to expect. Now, we're talking about a game where you have learned not to expect anything. But, I mean, I think he can get round, and I think he can do well. And the only question, as we've talked about, is 72 holes split over 4 days, or, frankly, 36 holes over 2 days, which he hasn't done because he played 18 last Tuesday, but since then it's only been 9 holes a day, and so we'll see. I hate to analyze step by step by step, but as I saw him coming down the 15th this morning, he looked older than 46. Let me just say that. I have my doubts in that regard on the walking part, not the swinging part though. The swinging part looks good.
So that's probably going to be the biggest challenge, I suppose, is just the endurance side of things of getting around this course, because as Greg mentioned yesterday, it's deceptively hilly, so it's tough on anyone to even just have the stamina to get around.
Yeah, I think he's very determined. I mean, I'll give it that. But yeah, even walking about, Shane, it's just, you know, you're going up and you're going down, and there's a number of holes where you're doing each. And as we saw, the other thing, the reference point I would have is everyone was raving about how he played in the PNC, leaving out the fact that not only was in a cart, but it was a scramble format with a really good player. I mean, Charlie's not the next Tiger, but his son was playing from tees that were 120 yards forward, and they scored well, and you just lost sight of what we're doing this week, which is far different from any other type of golf.
One, I suppose, storyline coming out of today, gentlemen, and I suppose, Greg, if I come back to yourself, is tournament chairman Fred Ridley done a bit of media today, and he mentioned that Phil Mickelson was not disinvited from the 86th Masters. Mickelson is obviously taking a break from golf following the fallout from his explosive comments about the PGA Tour and the Saudi-backed rival circuit, the six-time major winner, accusing the former of obnoxious greed and acting like a dictatorship. The 51-year-old also admitted he was well aware of Saudi Arabia. His human rights record was using the threat of a breakaway to reshape how the tour operates. And there was a quote as well from a journalist that covers the golf as well that mentioned it shows the respect and reverence Phil has for the institution of Augusta National and the Masters. Greg, what's your take on this whole saga, I suppose? And is this a storyline that I suppose the Masters won't want getting too much traction?
Well, firstly, yeah, Fred Ridley did confirm, you know, something that was in the ether, that whether or not Augusta might have disinvited Phil, and that's been firmly ruled out by Fred Ridley, the chairman of Augusta National, saying in his press conferences addressed to the tournament and to the press and to the nation of golf, I suppose, that no, Tiger or Phil Mickelson had texted him around late February, early March, to say that he did not wish to take up his spot in the Masters. So there was no question of him being disinvited, no matter what it is the view of what Phil did, said, whatever. He wasn't disinvited by Augusta. He's made that choice himself. And I think we also saw something earlier this week in a press conference of Bryson DeChambeau, when he was asked about Phil, and I expected Bryson to say nothing, but he said something quite, I thought, revealing. When he said, have you had any contact with Phil, or the questioner from the press conference, over the last while? And basically, Bryson DeChambeau, who somehow has a fair bit in common with Phil Mickelson for reasons which we won't go into, their nature and character have certain elements in common. But he said, no, it was basically radio silence, that it's all gone black and that there isn't any communication with Phil. So it does look as though Phil is dealing with stuff which is possibly a lot deeper than might have appeared on the surface, and he had alluded to that at some stage, that he has got some personal issues that he needs to either clear himself of quite quickly if he wants to defend his PGA championship, because that's coming up in 5-6 weeks time. So but one thing is for sure, he was not disinvited here. And that, Doug, you sat in that press conference, that was the vibe you got too.
I did. And whether there was a point where Phil was wise enough to act first and text, knowing that he wants to keep a good relationship with Augusta. It's not like Augusta called him and said, you're not welcome here, or we've changed the combination to your locker, or anything else like that. That much is clear. I think the biggest question of all is not only where is Phil now, which nobody knows, but what exactly is Phil doing this very minute? I mean, he's got a long road ahead of himself. There's a great deal of embarrassment for the remarks even getting out, and it really exposed himself. And how is he going to face the room? How is he going to face the public? It is a long road ahead. And two, Greg, I would also say that, you know, we want to see the book coming out in May, which takes on a lot more interest. And there's another book by the noted gambler Billy Walters, with whom Phil was caught up in an insider trading scheme, in which Billy Walters is the one that went to prison. That's coming out in the fall, and that might be even more damaging. So we've got a long road ahead for Phil.
And I think the longer that it goes, that he stays away from golf, and in a way, you know, we've seen Tiger Woods coming here to play in Augusta after 14 months after a physically debilitating experience of, you know, pretty much the highest order you can have in sports and still have the ability to make a comeback. You're going to see Phil Mickelson coming back at some point, having had a fairly serious we don't know to what degree Phil is in a mental state right now, in terms of clearly he can't be in a great position if he's not playing in the Masters, and, you know, an event that he's won three times, and clearly is someone who loves it. But Phil's comeback is going to be quite difficult the longer this goes on.
And one reason it makes it's difficult, if you go back to Tiger's own personal scandal back in 2010, he was only, at the time, he was 34 years old. And still not going through the injuries he had. He had time on his side. Phil's got no time on his side. He's going to turn 52 this summer. He doesn't have a lot of really good golf left to win people back through the performance, which is what they all tune into at the end of the day anyway. And the Champions Tour is not going to cut it. It's, you know, Tiger had majors, and Tiger was allowed to try to become Tiger again, and Phil just doesn't have time, does he?
Yeah, certainly will be interesting, I suppose, as the story develops there. And as you mentioned as well, Doug, there is a couple of other narratives and side issues that will reveal themselves in due course. But getting back to the action, and Greg, I think I'm right in saying you backed DJ outright last night when Marie posed the question to you. And Doug, I will be coming to yourself with a very similar question as to who you will see triumphing. But I just want to get your thoughts, Doug, on the Irish in action, because Greg and Gary kind of spoke very detailed and very elegantly about the Irish golfers that will be playing at this year's Masters. But for yourself, obviously Roy McIlroy, Seamus Power, Padraig Harrington is still there, and indeed Shane Lowry. How do you assess their chances? Obviously, they'll have different targets they'll be setting themselves.
I love what Rory said the other day when he didn't realize Padraig was in the field, by the way. I think that's fantastic. And I spoke to him about a month or so ago, and he made it clear, I'm not there to smell flowers. I'm not a ceremony guy. I'm there to properly try and play well. And he's... look, he's not gonna win this week, but I think he's playing better and he works hard. Rory, Seamus, let me back up. Who's played? I think outstanding and you know, probably could have won at least once, if not twice more, coming into this thing. And I just think he's just got a rock solid game and a rock solid head. I think that's what impresses me the most about Seamus. Rory, for whatever reason, and this may go against conventional wisdom. I realize it's been a couple of years, I guess 17, that Rory was in the last group with Patrick Reed. Was it 18? 18. And had a chance and lost the chance, and so be it. To me, for Rory, it's all about more the first 2 days than the last one. And I think that's the most important thing facing him mentally, is to not shoot himself out of it, at least on the first 2 days and possibly the third, and then just be whimsical enough to go out and play Rory golf and not worry as much as maybe he has in the past, and just let his talent and his freedom take over. And Shane, I haven't seen enough of him to know what kind of form he's in, but he's one of my favorite golfers. I just love his hands and I love his fight, but I can't, his knowing when he's going to show up still is a mystery to me.
Well, we'll be interesting to see how Shane Lowry goes, and he was chatting to Greg Allen a little bit earlier on today.
I feel great coming in here. My game is in pretty good shape. I don't know how it's going to go. I'm obviously very hopeful and quietly confident that I can, you know, do something good this week. But like I said, it's Augusta National. You just don't really know. You just have to go out there and give it your all and see where it leaves you at the end of the week.
You have a couple of top 25 finishes in your last two appearances here. Now, that sounds modest for someone who's an Open champion. But it's an indicator, perhaps, that you have got to grips with what's required here to play well.
Yeah, I think I'm starting to figure out the place a little bit better. You know, I struggled here the first couple of years. I struggled to kind of find my way around here, and I made mistakes where you probably shouldn't be making mistakes. So yeah, there's a couple of different, you know, playing the course a little bit different than I probably did at the start. Maybe I'm even looking at some options to play the course maybe a little bit different again this week to kind of take some trouble out of play. But I'm all for this week is... I'm out there playing my practice round, but I'm off for this week. I just need to hit the shot that I'm faced. That's in front of me. You know, I don't need to worry about where I'm leaving the shots or stuff like that. I just need to hit the shot that's right there in front of me, and that's all I can focus on this week. You know, it's so easy out there and when you're playing a practice round to hit all the most difficult chips and the most difficult putts, but I just want to go out there and play my golf and, like I said, just hit the shot that's there in front of me, and hopefully, you know, I shoot some good scores. I think I can play well this week. I'm quietly confident about how I am going into this, but you just don't know. You just really don't know.
Greg, Shane Lowry in good form when you were chatting to him earlier?
Yeah, and Shane, I think, feels that he's got everything that it takes to win here in terms of the physical aspects of his game. There is a lot of people who are out there not looking at the statistics, but just looking at the odd time he misses putts. They don't realize that everybody misses putts, and that statistically Shane Lowry's in the top 25 in the two main putting statistic categories on the PGA Tour right now. So that's basically the top 12%. And that's all you need to be. I mean, you know, when other parts of your game, like his iron play has improved enormously over the last 4 to 5 years. It was not a weakness, but it was never a strength. Now it's a strength. He puts the ball in the play adequately long enough off the tee. He doesn't go after it, perhaps, as, you know, like other players do. He's got a very smooth, languid approach to the game. So you never see Shane lashing at anything. So he doesn't go for outright distance with the driver. But he still hits it out there 300 plus yards. So he's got everything. But he himself said, like when I was chatting to him and when the mic was shut off, he was saying, look, you can have all the physical aspects of your game place come to, the Masters. But as Porter Carrington said, this is the ultimate test. The precision element of the game, I mean, it only starts really from fairway in, and hopefully you have hit a fairway. If you're off the fairway and you're wrong side of the fairway, it becomes very, very difficult, because the green complex is here. It's not so much about putting. It's about where you put your ball on the green or where you miss the green. You can miss the green short left on some putting surfaces and be an awful lot better than being 20 feet from the flag just above the hole on other surfaces. And there are not too many challenges like this. Even though we've had lots of heavy rain, I'm sure there's going to be, dry, firm greens. And once those greens, not bake out at the weekend, it's not going to get terribly hot, but it's going to be dry over the days from Friday to Sunday. Come Sunday, when it really counts, back nine, it'll be about a very, very high precision physical challenge for the golfer, as Harrington said, the ultimate test. And then it's all between the ears, which also Harrington said, and goodness knows he knows enough about what goes on between the ears. So that's, and I think Shane has a good chance, probably the best chance he's ever had. I think he's in a really good place.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a mental challenge as much as it is a physical challenge. You mentioned who's going to be in contention come Sunday evening. Greg, I'm right in saying you were going with Dustin Johnson yesterday. I don't want to be putting words in your mouth, but who do you think will
be
in?
I think you might have misheard. I was going on and on about Dustin Johnson, and then I said, I'm going to go for Cameron Smith.
Oh, my apologies, Greg. My apologies.
No, it would be very easy to think that I went for Dustin Johnson. I tell you what it is. I really believe, I'm not going to go through the level of detail yesterday, but yesterday, I just really think that Dustin Johnson has the game that, when it's on, is perhaps the most archetypally fit for winning around here. I just think, I know what he did in November 2020 was on a softened course and in a November Masters. And I don't think that he thinks that's in any way a diminished achievement. Admittedly, 20 under par around here was obscenely good scoring. And I think the November conditions enhanced that. But he did play brilliantly that week, and he drove the ball brilliantly that week. And I think there were signs over the last couple of weeks that Dustin has the components to really challenge here. But I just love everything about Cameron Smith's game with regard to Augusta. And he was tied second behind Dustin Johnson, albeit a fair few shots off the winning score back in 2020. And Cameron Smith is a player who dealt with the circumstances on the final 18 holes in the Players' Championship, which is also a tricky assignment on a Sunday, so brilliantly that it looks like he has even the mental components to go alongside the physical components of the game. And Cameron Smith has everything, tee to green and on the greens.
Okay, good stuff. Cameron Smith, apologies, Greg. We'll be chatting tomorrow and Friday, and I'll make sure to be leading with Cameron Smith there. Must be Gary who backed DJ. Doug, my final question will go to yourself, I suppose. I won't be putting any golfers into your mouth or preempting who you might be guessing, but who do you think will be leading the way come Sunday evening?
I want to say one thing, Shane. I can easily see why you confused Greg, because he just spent the last, it felt like an hour and a half talking about DJ. So I can see how that happens. I actually kind of like DJ. He is trending, and just not putting enough, not seeing enough putts go in. I'm going to throw out Xander Schauffele. Why, I don't know. He's got all the tools. He was right there last year, actually, when Hideki started coming back until an 8-iron into the pond on 16. He was there when Tiger won in 19, except for a putt here, a chip here, and as it goes for everybody who doesn't win. This is a smooth kid who doesn't have a ton of weakness and has a very good attitude, as we talk about, between the ears. Really delivered in a fairly high-pressure situation, given his heritage, to win the Olympic gold last year. And the kind of the funny thing about Xander is that he hasn't won a tournament in like 3 years, even though he had the low score at the Tour Championship with their preset scoring that went to DJ. He won the Olympic gold, and that doesn't count as a, quote, Tour victory. And I think this is his year. He and his best buddy, Patrick Cantlay, kind of stand out to me, even though they haven't been in Patrick hasn't been in the best form, which is still not terrible for him. And I think I'm turning into Greg. I think I'm talking about everybody else, but I'll stick with Shoffley.
Oh, I think you were going to start with Xander there and then just turn to Patrick Antley as well. But listen, Doug Ferguson.
Shane, I'll tell you, Shane, the last thing that it's such an open field. It might be the most open Masters I've been to, and I've been coming since 99. And I think Doug might feel the same.
I was thinking to myself, you have six players who could reach number one in the world. You have, I think, eight of the top 10 or in the world are under 30 and playing well. And at 10:34 tomorrow, Tiger Woods is going to tee off, and none of it's going to matter. at least in the viewing and the feeling about what this Masters is about. It's amazing.
So you could have a scenario of Xander Schauffele 9 under par after 11 holes tomorrow, but let's go to Tiger putting for double bogey. let's hope that's not the case. But, you know, it's very much a case that the first 2 days here are just going to be all Tiger. I just can't see it being anything else because the level of interest is enormous. Oh, well, you know, understandably so. It's an extraordinary thing to see him teeing up here. That's if he does not make a last-second decision to not tee up tomorrow morning. Don't think there's any prospect of him not teeing up, Doug?
I don't think so. He wouldn't be here without it. He would have left by Monday. Or after Hideki Sushi last night. One of the two.
Well, it will be interesting to see how it goes. There are sure to be plenty of twists and turns over the course of the next few days. Doug Ferguson, thank you very much. Greg Allen, thank you very much. As always, Greg, we'll be checking in with you tomorrow evening, and hopefully Tiger will have teed off. He is due to tee off at 3:30 Irish time. Harrington will be teeing off at 1:10. Shane Lowry at 3 p.m. Seamus Power at 5:24 p.m. And Rory McIlroy at 7:03. They are all Irish times. So, from golf to horse racing in a few moments' time. But just before we do, it is competition time. And I'm delighted to say we have a FIFA 22 competition. Dublin artist Aches has teamed up with EA Sports to create an exclusive Dublin City kit for FIFA 22. Known for his murals and graffiti art, Aches moves from the street to football by designing a unique kit, bringing Dublin to life in-game. This limited edition vanity kit is now available in FIFA Ultimate Team. And to celebrate its release, we have a copy of FIFA 22 to give away each day this week. Not only that, but one of our five daily winners will get their own signed limited edition Aches jersey. So, to be in with a chance to win today and get in the draw, all you have to do is answer the following question. Which Spanish team do Chelsea face in tonight's Champions League quarter final? If you know the answer, text us your answer, your name and where you're from to 51552. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details. So, as promised, we'll be turning our attention to horse racing in the company of Ruby Walsh in a few moments' time. Stay with us.
RTE 2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Racing.
Now you're very welcome back to Game on this Wednesday evening as we turn our attention to horse racing in the company of Ruby Walsh. Ruby is currently over in Aintree, and again, Ruby, in a similar manner to Cheltenham, I cannot hide my professional jealousy that you are over in Aintree, working hard over the next couple of days, and we'll be checking in with you over the course of the festival. Obviously the big one is on Saturday, but there's so much to look forward to before we get to the Grand National itself. The festival itself takes place tomorrow, is day one. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the races themselves, I saw an article this morning on the RTÉ website that read Aintree began watering this morning in anticipation of another drawing day ahead of the 3-day Grand National meeting, which starts tomorrow. Forecasts have varied in the build-up to the meeting, and with less than an expected 0.6 millimetres of rain falling last night and 0.8 millimetres in the previous 24 hours, clerk of the course Suleka Varma has decided to selectively water parts of the course. Have started to dry out already. So what is the weather like over there? What's the going like, and how's everything in Aintree, Ruby?
Oh, everything is great, Shane, but as you know yourself, I mean, you probably get from Dublin to Liverpool quicker than you get from Dublin to Galway. So the weather is not that dissimilar here in Liverpool than it was when I left Dublin only a couple of hours ago. And it's so changeable. You wouldn't even know what to wear. I mean, one minute it's sun is shining, the next minute the wind is blowing, and it's threatening terrain. But look, they have decided to water an entry this afternoon to make sure that the meeting starts on ground that is on the slow side of good. But tomorrow's forecast is somewhat unpredictable. And I mean, it depends on where you look, but it could be an absolutely horrible day here in Liverpool tomorrow. Wind, rain, and it could be a blustery one, reminiscent maybe of 2019, the last time there were crowds here at this wonderful meeting. And I think Aintree have made a great effort tomorrow. Jockey Club Racecourses and Aintree Racecourse have given 10,000 tickets to the frontline workers here in the UK, the NHS workers, to come to Aintree tomorrow afternoon. So I think that's a very kind gesture on their behalf.
Brilliant, yeah, absolutely. It's an eagerly anticipated meeting, and it is great to have fans back and sure to be packed to the rafters. So the first race, the Grade 1, 1:45, Ruby, that the fans that are present will be able to view. I suppose from an Irish perspective, what stands out to me straight away, Rachel Blackmore is obviously going to be taking part with Gin on Lime. Who should we be keeping an eye out for besides Gin on Lime, I suppose?
Yeah, well, look, Gin on Lime is coming here fresh, Shane. She hasn't run since Cheltenham in November, when she was a fortuitous winner. My Drogo looked like he was coming to take her measure when he fell at the second last, and Gin on Lime, well, I suppose kind of did fall. She went all the way to the ground, but Rachel Blackmore managed to stay on her back, and she ended up running out a ready winner. So look, Gin on Lime is coming in here off the back of a break, and it's Paul Nicholls and Colin Tizard that have the big opposition, both obviously from the West Country in the UK. Paul Nicholls runs Pick Dory, Colin Tizard runs Warlord, and I kind of like Warlord. I thought he ran a really good race at the Cheltenham Festival behind Edward Stone, where he finished fourth in the Arkell. I thought he got outpaced or didn't have the speed to go with them around the third last fence, and looked like finishing a bad seventh as they approached the second last, but he really stayed strongly from there home to finish fourth. And I think the extra distance in tomorrow's Manifesto Novice Chase would really suit him and get the meeting off to a good start for Brendan Powell and Colin Tizard, who have a live chance in Saturday's Grand National with Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay, well, it could be a good start for Tizard there. That is the 1:45 Novices Chase. We're straight in then to another Grade 1 at 2:20. It is the Juvenile Hurdle. I suppose two horses dominate this race in Triumph Hurdle, third Pied Piper, and the Boodle Fred winner, Brazil, both trained in Ireland. Brazil is a full brother to a St. Ledger winner, so has the pedigree, and he can land the hat-trick here at the expense of Pied Piper, having had an extra couple of days recovery time. Is a narrative that is out there. I'm not sure if you agree or disagree, or what's your take on this, Ruby?
I thought you were giving your own opinion, and I was thinking, God, Shane knows an awful lot more about horse racing than I thought he knew, because you were pretty much giving me my opinion, Shane. I agree. I think Brazil did win the Boodles Fred Winter at Cheltenham. He gave £8 to a horse called Gaelic Warrior. But I don't think that tells the whole story. Brazil got badly hampered at the second hurdle, and I think really did really well to win that race. And he's taken on Pied Piper, who was third in the JCB Triumph Hurdle. Now, Pied Piper is reunited with Davy Russell. Obviously, Davy rode Field Or at the Cheltenham Festival, who finished second. Pied Piper finished third behind Vauban, and he's a very good horse. I think the Irish will win this. I'm on the side of Brazil. Parik Roach trains him, of course, who is son of legendary jockey and trainer Christy Roach. Mark Walsh takes the ride in the colours of JP McManus, and, you know, I think they can take on Davy Russell and Gordon Elliott, and I think take them down with Brazil. He's a horse I've been taking with. He's a huge pedigree, and he's a rapid improver. And look, I think we might struggle to win the first one, Shane, but I think Ireland will get on the score sheet in the second.
Yeah, I think I must put that down to diligent journalistic research. I think the odds would be very large that anyone is tuning into Game On for my horse racing opinion, Ruby. But moving on.
You're giving a good one anyway, so take the praise and take the credit.
Absolutely, I'll keep that for the show reel. Moving on then to the Betway Bowl Chase of 5:3. I'll give a shorter run into this, and I'll just lead with Ruby, the Betway Bowl Chase, 2:55, Grade 1 tomorrow. What's your thoughts?
I think it's a tricky one, and it's a very hard race to get a handle on. Look, Protectorat is your favourite. I think for a 7-year-old, he had a pretty hard race in the Cheltenham Gold Cup, and I kind of would be opposing him. Clan de Zobo is next in the betting for Paul Nicholls and Harry Cobden. He wears blinkers for the first time. This time last year, they put cheek pieces on him to concentrate his thoughts and make him go forward, and it worked a treat. He then went to Punchestown, where he beat Album Photo. This time around, he was second in the King George. That was a bit fortuitous. I think Asterion Ferlange was going to be second when he fell at the last, and I thought Clandas Obo's run at Newbury was a bit disappointing. Maybe the blinkers will spark him into gear. He is a fresh horse, and he has freshness over most of his opposition here. Conflated was a really good winner of the Paddy Power Gold Cup in Leopardstown, and he fell at the Cheltenham Festival, fell at the second last when I thought he was going to finish second to Alaho, which is a pretty strong run, but it was a pretty heavy fall, and he has to show that he's over that. Ken Boy a good run at Leopardstown at Christmas in the Savills Chase when he was third behind Galvin and just behind a Plutar, but his last run behind Conflated leaves him with a lot of ground to make up on Conflated. He did win this race in 2019, and there could be similar weather conditions tomorrow afternoon to the ones that he faced on that occasion. And then you have Eldorado Allen, who was third behind Aloha at Cheltenham, and Roy Pagoy, who was fifth in the Gold Cup. So many horses in here, Shane, with chances and a hard race to get a handle on. If you were forcing me to pick one, I'd probably go with Conflated. But I think from a punting point of view, it's probably a race you're best off watching.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of short odds there as you kind of look at the starting field there on paper. The final Grade 1 of the opening day is at 3:30. It is the Aintree Hurdle. And from a casual horse racing viewer that I am, I'm looking at that and what strikes me is it's Elliot v. Henderson. Am I wrong?
It is. It is. And it's the Champion Hurdle second and third. Epitone 2 was second. Zanahir was 2 was third. Now look, it has looked for most of the year, Shane, that Zanahir was the kind of horse who would improve when he stepped up in trip. He's getting that tomorrow afternoon. He's stepping up to 2.5 miles, and his stamina should come to the fore. I don't think the pace of the Champion Hurdle really suited him. It was a slowly run race and he got done for speed by Honeysuckle and Epitant, and all the arrows are pointing towards Zanahir, but I can't help but feeling that perhaps at this stage of her career, a step up in trip is going to suit Epitant as well. As a 3-year-old, she was able to win over 1 mile and 4 furlongs in France. She's now an 8-year-old, 5 years down the line. Horses aren't that different to humans. They get a bit slower as they get older, and they tend to want to have to go a bit further where things are happening slower for them. So I'm probably in the Epitant camp. I think she made a mistake at the last hurdle in Cheltenham, and only for it, it would have been a much more clear-cut result between herself and Zanahir. So I'm going against the Irish horse and Zanahir, and I'm going with Epitant. I think the step up and trip, as much as it's going to suit Zanahir, will really suit her as well.
Okay, well, they are the 4 Grade 1s. There are 3 other races later tomorrow afternoon, 4:05, 4:20 to 5, and 4:15, the Hunter's Chase, which is the first race of the week over the bigger fences in the Fox Hunters, 20:05. This will be a fast and furious miles around the sharp track of Aintree, which bizarrely isn't what Red Rum was famed for, but this is the race that bears his name. It is, of course, the Red Rum Handicap Chase, and then we have the Fat Race to finish off the day. Anything quirky or outstanding should be looking forward to out of these three?
I think when you look at the Fox Hunters, which will be traditionally the amateurs Grand National, or the amateurs version of the Grand National, Shane, Jet ran in last year's Grand National and he led the field from the start to almost the home turn. He led the Grand National last year for the best part of 4 miles. Sam Whaley Cohen rides him for his father Robert, and I think if he can put up a similar sort of showing in this much weaker race than what the Grand National will be, I think the drop back in trip will suit Jet, and I thought he was interested in the 4:05. In the 4:40, as you've rightly said, the Red Rum Handicap Chase, no one can ever figure out why Red Rum, the most famous Grand National horse of all time, why exactly his name was put to a 2 mile chase, but it's there and that's it. And the one I like is Gaelic Coast for the all-conquering Donald McCain yard. He'll be ridden by Brian Hughes, the man from Northern Ireland who's going to be crowned champion jockey in the UK this year for the second time. And I think Gaelic Coast, dropping back in trip after his run in Cheltenham in January behind Tord and Frayed, where he travelled really strongly but didn't seem to get home, I think dropping down to 2 miles will really suit him. And in the last, well, William Mullins has a runner in the bumper, Ashro Diamond. Patrick Mullins is going to ride her. She ran well at the Dublin Racing Festival behind Lily de Burley. But I think Rosie Red Rum, if ever there was a name destined to win an entry, it's surely this one. She is favourite, but I thought she was slightly unlucky at Newbury behind Top Dog, and she could be too powerful for Ashro Diamond.
Okay. Good stuff, Ruby, as always. I sincerely hope I haven't peaked already in my horse racing summation on the juvenile hurdle already, so we're only chatting.
Well, you're going to have to really, really read whatever.
That's top my head, Ruby.
You were reading a podcast you were listening to, Shane, because you're going to have to come up with a good one tomorrow.
Right, well, the pressure is on. Ruby, we'll be checking in with you tomorrow and indeed Friday. You're over at Aintree for the week. Ruby Walsh, pleasure as always.
Cheers, Shane.
RTE 2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM. 2FM.
Hi, you're very welcome back to Game On this Wednesday evening. And it's great to have your company in a big preview special. So we've the horse racing out of the way, we've the golf out of the way as we turn our attention now to the Lidl National Football League finals and the Littlewoods Ireland League Camogie finals. But first, we will stick with football in the company of Nadine Doherty. Nadine, pleasure as always to chat. So two league finals this weekend. We have Armagh v Kerry up at 2 o'clock, and then at 4 o'clock it is Donegal Meath. In terms of team news and talking points, I suppose the quotes coming out of the Meath camp surround the Meath manager Eamon Murray. So the league launch was yesterday. RT Sports' Clara Hester was out at that, and obviously the news of Vicky Wall going down under. So the 2021 Senior Players Player of the Year Vicky Wall is set for life down under with the AFLW later this year, according to Eamon Murray. And the Meath manager believes her departure will be a loss to the game in Ireland. Excuse me. And the quote he mentions is, "That is going to happen, yeah. I'd say we're losing Vicky now in September. I don't know how many more we'll lose. I don't know why you'd want to play that sport, because it's dreadful stuff to watch. I can't understand it. There's no skill at all." Nadine, your thoughts on that?
Well, he didn't hold back, did he?
At least, listen, we give out that no one is honest anymore.
Yeah, no, 100%. I share similar sentiments with Eamon, for sure. He was right as well. He said on a Monday, you can just tune in and watch all the games in an hour. I thought, interestingly, that what he also said, Shane, that players who've returned in the past have underwhelmed in their county jerseys. And he said he feels that a returning player won't win a championship for any team. He named Sinead Goldrick and Lauren McGee as examples. I suppose he was looking at last year. But you'd wonder, is this a message to Meath players maybe? You know, other than Vicky, her maybe thinking about going. Look, with Vicky, it's a massive loss. You know, she's kind of become the face of the LGFA. We don't have to go on about what an amazing player she is, but she's 23, and you know, from her perspective and others, it's the opportunity to be in a completely professional setup. Although Eamon said, "How many times a week do you want to train?" Is it a few times not enough?
Yeah.
But and it's not the money, because you know, I know that coming back, these girls, they don't come home loaded with money. But you wouldn't blame her. You know, we'll miss watching her, but she's going down there for professional sport, the weather, travel, and you'd wish her all the best. But I really hope it's not a trend. You know, because we were kind of going the other way the last few years, that fewer players were going, but we'll really miss Vicky. And look, maybe the deal will fall through at the last minute, but I doubt it.
Yeah, we'll be interested to see. Obviously, the likes of Cora Staunton, Breach Stack, Niamh McAvoy have all done well over there. And a massive congratulations to Orla O'Dwyer, who has picked up an All-Australian Guernsey for her impressive AFLW season with the Brisbane Lions. Tipperary native becomes the first ever Irish female recipient of the coveted All-Star. She's the first Irish-Australian since 1993, when Jim Steins won his second All-Australian award as part of the Melbourne Demons. So a massive congratulations there to Orla O'Dwyer. So yeah, you mentioned there, we'll be interested to see if this is something familiar that we see. We hope not, because obviously we want all the big names playing in the big games, and Vicky Wall will be starring for Meath. And it is Meath against Donegal, and the big names that she'll be facing for Donegal, I want to talk about the likes of Yvonne Bonner, Roisin McCafferty back for Donegal in goal. I suppose that has really solidified a really good defensive unit that we've seen from Donegal this year, and the importance of Geraldine McLaughlin. So there are a few key stars for Donegal.
Yeah, really key. Roisin took a couple of years out. I think key with Roisin, her kickouts, the way she acts as a seventh defender also is huge to Donegal's possession game. Look, we talk about Yvonne and Geraldine all the time. I think what's key with the whole forward and back matchups there, Meath are conceding a lot in terms of physical strength and height. You have Katie Hearn, Karen Guthrie, Yvonne, they're all 5'9", 5'10", real strong girls. You have Niamh McLaughlin, I think, who'll probably be marking Emma Troy, probably cut out Emma Troy's attacking. So really interesting matchups. But these teams haven't played each other competitively, Shane, since 2016. So, you know, you could talk about what will and won't happen, but who knows? Intriguing. But two very different teams. You have Meath, young, started off their whole trajectory winning. You have Donegal, they're coming to the end of a cycle. They've won very little. So we'll see.
Two very differing styles. And my next question now, I want an objective answer.
Okay.
When push comes to shove as to who is going to win. I know you're a proud Donegal woman, but in terms of the 60 minutes of football that we'll see, how will it pan out?
Look, Meath, they're heavy favourites.
Like, yeah.
You know, they're all Ireland champions. More explosive brand of football. They're playing better football. Defensive records are very similar. Two best defensive records in the league to date. It's very hard to look past Meath. You know, I'd love to... You know, go with Donegal on this one, but the head has to go with Meath, unfortunately.
Well, it's sure to be a competitive match. Just very briefly, Armagh, Kerry due to be competitive as well. How do you see that one going?
Armagh all the way. I think, you know, Kerry, they've been knocking on the door. This is their third final in 4 years. They've been really struggling to get out of Division 2, but I just think that Armagh attack, it's really been firing. They've scored an incredible 14.53 in four games. You have the Mackens, Ethan McCoy, Niamh Reel, Kelly Mallon will probably come back into the fold, their captain. Really hard to look past them. And with Kerry, it's the same old, that over-reliance on Louise na Mhairitig. So Armagh, I think, all the way. And they'll have a say in the championship.
Yes,
definitely.
They certainly will. Yeah. Really looking forward to that championship. And indeed, really looking forward to the two matches on Sunday. If we welcome Aoife Murray into the conversation. And Aoife, before we get on to the Camogie final, I just want to get both your thoughts. This week, the GAA launched a new 5-year strategic plan aimed at growing and sustaining the association between now and 2026. GAA President Larry McCarthy was amongst those at the launch. And one of the plan's stated initiatives is the development of a roadmap to form one association to govern all Gaelic games codes. A major survey undertaken by the association steering group last September found more than 80% of respondents felt that the GAA, LGFA and Camogie Association should strive to form one association, which is brilliant to see. And we've talked, you know, about this before, Nadine, but even optically there is a narrative going around that this was announced and everyone that was at this were all just GAA representatives.
Yeah, I thought that was an open goal missed by the GAA. Get Helena Rourke there, get a few women there. A bit of diversity wouldn't have gone amiss, lads. I think they made two huge mistakes. First, it seems like they've fallen into the old trap of having like-minded people only involved in this plan. And we all know what happens there. Instead of wrestling with hard questions and being dynamic in your thinking, the group settles for token answers to token questions. I think, secondly, the GAA don't seem to have taken time to acknowledge that Camogie and LGFA voted a huge and brave yes in Congress. Maybe pause the launch, involve the other two at the table. Just disappointing that the opportunity was missed, and not a great start for the blended family approach, really, is it?
Aoife, would you agree?
Yeah, pretty much along the same lines as Nadine. I think it might have been better to take maybe a pause and have all the family there rather than just one part of it. In many ways, look, it is welcomed, and it's great to see us moving away from, you know, the cooperation and collaboration language and having a bit more action. But I suppose what was really missed there was the LGFA and Camogie. They should have been involved in it. Haven't heard a huge amount from them since this was launched either, which possibly points to Nadine's point of it being one part of society there promoting this. Good to read to a certain extent some of the points under governance and operations. And as I said, for that such strong language of form one association to cover all Gaelic games codes, which to me should point to obviously a new body. It's not just a rehashed version of the GAA, but it is actually a new body encompassing all of our Gaelic games. Certainly maybe a little bit of an own goal.
Well, it will be interesting to see how that one goes, and Nadine and Aoife, I'm sure, will be having this conversation over the coming weeks. And unfortunately, we are just pushed for a bit of time, so we have to move on to the Camogie League finals, Aoife, and obviously a big one this Saturday evening in Croke Park. Cork will be hoping for a better return than their last visit to GAHQ when they take on Galway in this Saturday's Division 1 final. How do you see this one going?
Look, I suppose It's going to be a tough one to call to many aspects of it. You know, last time Cork won was 2013. We're not very good over the last probably 15 years in the league. However, Galway's been more competitive over the last 5 years. For me, it's a little bit of advantage to Galway. They played 2 weeks ago. It's been 4 weeks since Cork had that competitive game. So certainly advantage Galway. From a Cork perspective, look, I think it's an important game for Cork to win. As a former teammate to many of these girls, I would love to see them win because it would be their own win as a new team, a new setup, etc. It would be a great confidence boost, but with the break in play, for me, it is a little bit of advantage to Galway.
Okay, well, it will be interesting to see how it goes this weekend. Aoife Murray, Nadine Doherty, both thank you very much for your company. As always, on a Wednesday evening, soccer's up next with David Snaid.
RTE 2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Football.
Now, just before we wrap up tonight's Game On, time to turn our attention to football. There is a night of Champions League to look forward to with David Snaith. But first, Peter Smith is at Turf Moor. There's a relegation six-pointer going on. Peter, you have the team news for us.
Yeah, it's a change of emphasis in attack for Sean Dyche, who makes three Burnley changes overall. Maxwell Cornet and Jay Rodriguez are in up top, along with our own Nathan Collins, who returns in defence. Jack Cork, Dwight McNeil and Kevin Long are relegated to the bench. As for Frank Lampard's Everton, Gerard Branthwaite is a surprise inclusion as one of two changes, with Anthony Gordon also in for a start. Michael Keane is ruled out through suspension. Demarai Gray is named as a sub, and he's joined on the bench by Seamus Coleman. It's going to be a night of real tension at Turf Moor, where Burnley meet Everton.
Thank you very much, Peter Smith. Relegation won't be decided this evening, but that result surely will go a long way to seeing who will go down. David Snaith, tonight is all about previews, so let's stick with that method. We're looking ahead at the Champions League football, Villarreal versus Bayern Munich, but Chelsea, Real Madrid, I suppose, is the standout tie this evening. How do you see that one going?
It's a standout tie, and when you look at it, it's also two teams who, at the moment, are just very peculiar. Like, I was looking there earlier on and just reading some of the previews are going around, and you listen to what's being said now about Carlo Ancelotti at Madrid. Like, it looks as if they're going to canter to the league title in Spain, 12 points clear. He's also on the brink of history. He can become the first manager ever to win the league in the top five leagues in Europe. I won't put you on the spot and ask you to tell me who they are right now.
I asked the questions, David. I asked the questions.
I know, exactly. I'm still reeling from the quiz a few weeks ago about Lee Sharp, when I had to cheat my way out of it and go on Google. But it's just a very odd one. Like you look at what Madrid did against PSG in the last round, where they were appalling away from home. Very fortunate to come away still in the tie against PSG, and then produce an amazing comeback to go through. And basically, I think that's what's kept, even though they're so kind of dominant in the league, because obviously Barcelona are struggling and Sevilla just haven't got the firepower.